Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black. Tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
With a bite. I'm your host, Rex, broadcasting to you from Whitewash City.
And this is Dex. I'm broadcasting to you from the Lone Star State, deep down here, deep in the heart of Texas. So, a lot of news has been going on this week, mostly around this issue of Benghazi and whatever in the hell was supposed to be going on there. And, this is something that popped up before the election. Everyone was like, hey, this doesn't make a lot of sense. And then it sort of disappeared because of the election, and it stayed gone for a while. Although it's like a watched pot, I guess. It never boiled, and apparently now it's coming to a boil. So new things are coming to light. More information is coming out. And we thought that it was something of interest that we should talk about on this show. So back to you, Rex, and get us kicked off here.
Benghazi, that's that actor that played the Roadhouse.
Yeah, I think he was in Roadhouse.
That was Ben Gazzara. I'm sorry. I confuse that all the time. Anyway, I thought you'd be bigger. The topic tonight, Benghazi, bend over, been lying. Clearly someone's been lying. Someone's been trying to bend us over. And this Benghazi thing is hardly about a small backwater town in Libya. It seems to be considerably bigger than that, and we don't have all the information yet, but the word hero is bandied about a lot. You know, who's a hero, who's, you know, you apparently if you're a gay basketball player and you tell people you're heroic, apparently if you stay silent as Kermit Gosnell murders babies in Pennsylvania, you're a hero. So it's a word that we're confused about these days, but I think we've got some genuine heroes here, because these so-called whistleblowers that have come forward in testimony in Congress, I think they've laid it on the line, and they've probably been threatened and bullied. I know at least one of them has been severely demoted, but I think that's what brought this thing back to the fore, and it should be, because it appears officials in our government, whether through gross incompetence or sinister actions, have put the lives of Americans at risk, and they are covering it up. You mentioned that this happened before the election. Obviously, it was September of last year that this happened, and clearly part of the cover-up was to avoid an election problem, considering I'm sure that Obama's internal polling was telling him that he'd lost about 13% of his 2008 voters, and he was scared of Willard Mitt Romney. The interesting thing is that Rove's Monster never pressed Obama on this issue. Isn't that suspicious?
Yes. Well, actually, he came out with a speech after this, very briefly, and he was roundly criticized for it. And he dropped the issue immediately because how dare could he insinuate this somehow was the fault of Obama. And Romney, of course, never having the spine for a fight, basically dropped the issue right away, apologized, and ran off screaming, which is really, when you think about it, kind of presidential behavior, really. I'm surprised Romney didn't win.
Bussy. Tex, real quick, I want to bring everybody up to speed because some people may not have been on this subject. Plus, since it's been so long that this Benghazi thing has been going on, maybe people are kind of unfamiliar with what transpired on September 11th, the attacks, the stories, the cover-up, all that kind of stuff. So we'll get a summary of that. But first, real quick, we are joined by a friend of the show, Carrie's a Club. Trog, you're live with Tex and Rex.
Gentlemen.
Hey,
are we
gonna, Chris.
Hey, buddy. Do we have a specific topic, or is it going to go wild?
Go wild, because the topic is huge. but we're trying to focus on this. Essentially what we're talking about here is government power and corruption, because, you know, this whole foreign policy mess that we're engaged in and this obfuscation of the events regarding Benghazi and the sheer disregard for the lives of Americans who put themselves at service. Let's be clear about something. Most people who join the Foreign Service do it out of a sense of service for their country. And if you have a military for any reason, especially since the constitutional military is the Navy and our brave Marines, if you have the Marines for any reason, it isn't to have 900 bases stomping around the world for an empire, but it is incumbent upon the federal government to have Marines stationed at every single embassy you have to defend Americans who are serving your country overseas in diplomatic positions. And that's exactly what they dropped. Now, we'll see, you know, where the topic goes, but we're going to do something a little unusual. I've got a clip, but it's a long clip. Usually we keep them to 3 or 4 minutes and talk about them. This one is actually almost 10 full minutes.
Oh, my God.
But it is quite excellent. So grab a beer and sit back. Unfortunately, this is from Fox News, but it is from Judge Jeanine Pirro's show. And as a former judge and prosecutor, you know, she's got that ability to do the opening argument and kind of succinctly put things together. This has been going on for months, and there's a lot of data. What she does here, and this was on her show last night, she kind of put all the pieces together in a really concise way. So I think it's a really good, even though it's 10 minutes long, summary of this topic. And then we'll come back on the other side of this and talk about it, unless either one of you's got something you want to tee up before I play Judge Jeanine.
No, that's it.
No,
all right. So, all right, everybody, grab your beer. You got 10 minutes. And pay attention, because she really does a good job.
The Obama administration lied to us. They misled us, and they left Americans to die. So what do we know? Fact. The president knew at 5 p.m. his consulate and ambassador were under attack. He simply told Joint Chiefs Chairman Dempsey and Defense Secretary Panetta to take care of it. He simply went to bed. He didn't even bother to call, never checking with them again. Fact, the next morning, the president takes Air Force One to fly to a Las Vegas fundraiser for himself while Americans burn in the Middle East. He can take Air Force One for a campaign fundraiser, but he can't send fighter jets to save Americans. Fact, the fight lasted 8 hours. fact, there was no spontaneous demonstration, no YouTube video that ignited the murderous fury in Benghazi, and they all knew it. It's not one fact, but each fact taken together is a connected whole that convinces us of what the truth is. And that truth? Jay Carney, Susan Rice, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, they all lied to us. Now, I'm tired of the sugarcoating. I'm tired of putting truth to the falsehood. A lie is a lie is a lie. Let's call it what it is. The whistleblowers changed everything. The ones who were instructed by Hillary's chief of staff, Cheryl Mills, not to speak to anyone alone in Benghazi, including congressmen. But Greg Hicks says it best.
The job now is a significant, it's a demotion. So I've been effectively demoted from deputy chief of mission to desk officer.
Mr. President, with all due respect, you actually demote the man who was on the phone all night scrambling to get help, destroying your classified records, chartering a plane, taking on the terrorist by himself. Why? Why would you do that? Why would you demote a hero? And why would you lie to us? I'll tell you why. Because of a looming presidential election 7 weeks away. Because Americans can't be under attack, especially not a terrorist attack, if, as you say, Al-Qaeda is already on its heels. Mr. President, how could you not send in reinforcements? How could you not send in Americans trained for this very kind of emergency? You're the commander-in-chief. That's your job. And enter Hillary Clinton. Fact, because the Benghazi consulate security was so substandard, it could only have been inhabited if you had issued the waiver. Fact, your department continuously denied both Ambassador Stevens and Deputy Chief of Mission Hicks' request for more security. Fact, you actually reduced security when everyone knew of the threats and the prior assaults on Benghazi. And please, don't even begin to try to sell us the idea that it was about saving money, because your own staffer, Charlene Lamb, who supposedly was dismissed, swore that the resources were not an issue, and my sources tell me Lamb is now up for an even higher post in the State Department. So, Hillary, why would you do this?
I did tell the Accountability Review Board that Secretary Clinton and wanted the post made permanent.
Oh, okay. Now we know. You wanted to arrive on your chariot and announce the establishment of a permanent mission in a normalized Libya. Normalized? When you last visited Libya, you had the Defense Department pre-position assets off the Libyan coast in case you needed rescue. How could you? And then you swear under oath, just back from weeks abroad, logging all those miles, recovering from the flu, the fall, the concussion, and the blood clot. You testify you didn't know a thing about your friend the ambassador's request for more security.
Any of the requests, any of the cables having to do with security did not come to my attention.
Now, Hillary, I know you were busy that night calling the president of Tunisia when all the action was in Libya. But you can't deny requests for more security in Benghazi and then blame the very people who asked for it. You can't have it both ways. And you want us to believe that you and the president are going to get the facts and get justice? You can't even get to the FBI, to the crime scene, for 3 weeks. And by the way, the FBI guys, they carry guns, don't they? If it takes them 3 weeks because it wasn't safe in Benghazi, how the hell is it safe enough for you to keep our civilian diplomats there? And what to do? Find some guys with impeccable reputations, beholden to your husband Bill, and ambassador named Pickering, an admiral named Mullen. Have them investigate and make sure they don't ask you any questions. Or talk to the guy in charge of the emergency response. And Pickering, he's perfect. He apparently believes America is already full of Islamophobes. And while you're at it, Hillary, why not throw the president of Libya under the bus too? The man who traveled to Benghazi at great personal risk, confirming almost immediately what you already knew, that it was a terror attack, and you basically call him a liar or clueless to the rest of the world. And how about your take on our money? You take it and buy an advertisement to apologize to the Arab world about a video that has nothing to do with Benghazi while they burn us in effigy. That'll keep the lie going, too. But they say we're obsessed with Benghazi. The New York Times says that our Benghazi obsession is all about hysterical allegations of crimes equal to Watergate. Really? My memory may not be all that great, but nobody died at Watergate, and no one was left on the battlefield. Our Congress, though, they're good. They'll get to the truth.
I find it truly disturbing and very unfortunate that when Americans come under attack, the first thing some did in this country was attack Americans, attack the military, attack the president, attack the State Department, attack the former senator from the great state of New York, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
You're kidding, right?
We have the best military in the world. But even with all of their technological advances, they could not get there in time.
Now, this guy hasn't even heard the testimony, and he's already accusing the man who has spent, who has the most to lose, his own life, and who was actually on the ground and in the battle of lying. And it gets worse.
Death is a part of life.
What difference at this point does it make?
It's as if they're saying, enough with the dead and on with the living, on to my next election. And remember this one?
The White House and the State Department have made clear that the single adjustment that was made to those talking points by either of those two of these two institutions were changing the word consulate to diplomatic facility because consulate was inaccurate.
Today we know that was a bold-faced lie. There were 12 deletions of references to terrorism at the instruction of the White House and the State Department. Hillary's henchwoman, that temple of veracity, Victoria Nuland, actually tells the CIA to remove any reference to the prior Benghazi security warnings because it could be used against Hillary. But my favorite, Leon Panetta. There just wasn't enough time. Listen to this one from 7 months ago.
A Monday morning quarterbacking going on here. Basic principle is that you don't deploy forces into harm's way without knowing what's going on, without having some real-time information.
There wasn't enough time? How did you know the fight wouldn't last 24 or 48 hours or more? In which case, you could have gotten rescuers there. You could have saved Americans, but you didn't even start the process because you had no intention of saving those lives. You should be ashamed of yourself. Yes, Wednesday was a sad day for me personally, for the families of those killed, and for any American who believes, as I do, that America is the citadel of honor and freedom. This past week, the dreams that I had as a little girl in that small town were shattered.
That's pretty powerful, and she covers a lot. You know, sorry for playing the long clip, but there was a lot of good stuff in there. Chris and Tex, you guys are live again.
Excellent. Well, she raises a lot of good issues as to what was going on during that time. But she touches on something which goes back to the chronology of this, which is that the Democratic National Convention was held 5 days prior to this event. And that during that, they were talking about how GM lives, Bin Laden's dead. And there was sort of this triumphalism over the death of Bin Laden, which, you know, Bin Laden died under Obama, and they certainly don't really have much of anything else to run on, so I don't blame them.
They got Egypt. They got Egypt in the
Sharia law take over and the abuse of and murder of Christians in Egypt to stand on.
All of the peace.
Exactly. So they raised this issue at the convention, and then 5 days later, after that, there's this big attack at the embassies. So they're doing this triumphalism thing. They're stating that, you know, Al-Qaeda's, then they're gone as an effective force, and then, oh, lo and behold, here they come, attacking several embassies simultaneously across the Middle East. Kind of makes you look a little ridiculous. So they decided, well, you know, this is bad for us, bad for our election opportunities, so we need to essentially come up with a new narrative. And that's what they did. They spun the new narrative that this all has to do with this video. And the person who made that, Nakula, something like that, I forget exactly what his name is. He's in prison now for making the video, which really had nothing to do with it. And Zawahiri's brother, the blind sheikh's brother, was out in front of the Egyptian embassy on 9/11 of 2012, being interviewed by CNN, stating that they were storming the embassy in order to try to free his brother from U.S. prison. So it never had anything to do with that video. Or if there were people there who were inflamed by that video, they certainly were in the minority. It was part of a larger effort.
And, I'm sorry, Tex.
Well, and so what I think they did is you have, you know, this is another thing that came out a little bit after that. This came out, when was it, mid-October or mid-November, I forget, but that's when, what's her name, Broderick, the woman who was having the affair with Petraeus, what was her name?
Right.
Yeah, anyway, she came out and said that Benghazi was being used as a detention facility for enhanced interrogations by the CIA. Right? And then everybody's like, well, how do you even know that? And then everything blows up kind of about her affair with General Petraeus. But if what she said is true, and I have no reason to doubt that what she said is true, if what she said is true, they had this attack going on at this enhanced interrogation facility in Benghazi, and you have the political problem of the fact that Al-Qaeda is back. Like, we need to hide the fact that Al-Qaeda had something to do with it. We completely need to hide the fact that we have this enhanced interrogation facility there because we said we shut them all down and we didn't participate in that kind of thing anymore. And then they have, at the same time, an initiative, which is UN Human Rights Commission Resolution 1618, which is an anti-blasphemy resolution. And it says, and Hillary Clinton is on board supporting this, that says the resolution, they will focus on, quote, combating intolerance, negative stereotyping, stigmatization of and discrimination, incitement to violence, and violent acts against persons based on religion or belief. So there's this anti-blasphemy clause, which has to do with portrayals of Islam, and they decided, hey, we can actually get some political hay out of this if we blame this guy who did this video, even though it really has nothing to do with this guy who did this video, but then we can get some bennies and use this maybe to get our human rights anti-blasphemy thing through the UN. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, except if your ideology happens to include the word Tea Party, Patriot, or 9/12, then there is no anti-blasphemy. In fact, we'll just send IRS after your ass.
Absolutely. And how can you have an anti-blasphemy thing that you're supporting at the United Nations level when you have freedom of speech as well?
Well,
once again, it's the left setting up competing sets of rights with the larger rights that Americans have being eroded away in light of the new rights that are being created. You know, I may disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Well, that's not what people believe anymore, certainly not people in the current group of people who are in charge.
Well, I mean, there's no question about it. And, I mean, one thing we know for sure, I mean, as these facts come out, because I think there's going to be more testimony and more information coming forward, the one thing we do know is there is a cover-up. And the only question is, who knew, how high did it go, and why are they covering it up? Sometimes these bureaucratic dildos just cover things up because of their incompetence, but sometimes they do cover their sinister and dastardly deeds as well. The simple fact is that, like you mentioned, that might have been a, quote, enhanced interrogation facility. It might have been who knows what the hell it was, but there's also allegations that there was some gun running going on from that, quote, consulate, principally to get weapons into Syria. And we know for a fact that the, quote, Free Syrian Army Syrian rebels come from 29 countries. They are Muslim jihadists, not secular Syrians who are seeking liberty from the yoke of the Ba'ath regime of Assad. These are Muslim jihadists that are either trying to set up a Turkish caliphate, a Salafist emirate, or a Egyptian type sultanate. We're not sure where they're from, but we know that a good bulk of them are from North Africa, specifically Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, and Morocco. And we know that there are a significant number of them also from the Caucasus, where the Tsarnaev brothers were from. So, you know, it seems that on the one hand, you've got some elements within our federal government that are supporting al-Qaeda and other types of Muslim jihadists, while we're ostensibly in an undeclared, non-geographically bound war against tactic, the war of terror. Okay, it seems as if we're pumping them up on the one side and speaking, you know, that we're going after them on the other. Of course, all the measures that we want to take against these Muslim jihadists that they're ginning up the fear of in the United States, these tools seem to be directed more and more against Americans rather than against the actual terrorists. It's not unusual in international geopolitics to end up with strange bedfellows. Ostensibly, when the CIA was backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet invasion, we basically were supplying al-Qaeda with weapons, and later bin Laden turned on us. You could probably give them a pass at that time, given the fact that we were engaged in, quote, the Cold War against the Soviets, and the fact that al-Qaeda hadn't trained their sights on us yet. But since then, they have. So why would we get back in bed with them ever again? It's just crazy. And I think what it highlights more than anything else is precisely what a genuine conservative and probably, historically speaking, Republican foreign policy is. Unless you have a direct interest or there is a direct threat against you, don't get involved in this stuff. You don't know who friend or foe is, and all you end up doing is screwing it up, being used, and getting a shitload of blowback. And I think that's precisely the message that Americans are looking for these days. Even people who might have been a little jingoistic, back in, after 2001, and there was the WMD and the tie-in with al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and all that, we've become war-weary. We've got a lot of dead and injured soldiers. We've got more money spent than we can afford. The force is stretched nearly to the level of breaking, and we're not getting any benefits out of it. We are less safe. We have more police state tyranny. We have more debt, and it's not working out. So people are tired of it, and frankly, a legitimate American foreign policy wouldn't get us hooked up in all these things. And I think that that's precisely what they're covering up, and the Republicans have a unique opportunity here to do something about it. Some of them are, posturing politically. I would say it's not necessarily a bad move to take Hillary out, since she's probably the most formidable challenger for 2016. But, there are certain stale moths type light in their loafers Republicans who are real hard on for this Benghazi thing, but they have just as much of a hard on for the gun running to Syria and the toppling of the secular Arab regime in Syria to replace it with a Muslim jihadi regime. So, you got to watch what they're up to. That's how I see it. I think this is just exposing the tangled web we weave when we start to poke around the hornet's nest.
Well, and if you go back to the Bush era, this whole thing about, these seven countries they were going to plan to topple anyway, which were all dictators that we, financed and funded at one time or another. And you look at it's just like the dominoes effect of what the original plan was is still going on. And I think that people are, the scary part to people who are aware is what the hell has taken over. This whole Arab Spring thing, and I remember you know, not to mention Fox News, but I remember when the Egypt thing was igniting, people were talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, and all the leftist media was downplaying the hell out of it. And anybody that had a brain that had done the research and knew the history on it knew that this was not a good situation. I watched that special that Glenn Beck did the other day on the Coptic Christians in Egypt, and that was kind of a heart-wrenching story. And none of this is getting any press on either side, including Fox News. I mean, people are being persecuted. They're being killed, raped, forced to marry. It's just unbelievable what's going on over there. And we're going, this is our allies? These are the people we spend billions of dollars to, jets and tanks. And we're like, what the hell are we doing? You know, McCain got on there. I'll never forget him getting on there, Fox, going, we got to send money. We've got to, you know, show these people that we care. And I'm thinking, what people? These people that are taking over this country? I mean, not that Mubarak was a good guy, but, you know, he was our guy, you know, and they had a secular relationship that allowed these other cultures and religions to coexist better than we're seeing now. And this is exactly what they want. It's, you know, what's going to happen in Libya. It's exactly what is going to happen in Syria if they take over. There's a whole big picture starting to pop up here. You know, we haven't talked about the Afghanistan and the SEALs that were killed. I don't know if you guys had an opportunity to watch that video. Did you watch that press release that I posted? It was heart-wrenching. Yep. Heart-wrenching, and it was disgusting. They sent those guys into unprepared in the wrong kind of vehicle. They wouldn't even let them fire on people on the ground because of the new rules of engagement. They just got a bunch of people killed, and it was the best of the best. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a bunch of army. I mean, not to downplay army, but, you know, these were SEALs. These are an expensive additive to our military, and they just sent them in there to get killed. You know,
these are the Jedi Knights. And isn't that the same? Reason they said why they didn't send them in to Benghazi? Because, you know, we didn't have the intelligence. We didn't know the horse crap. Because let's be clear about something. You know, bad intelligence happens, but intentionally bad intelligence is unexcusable. Secondly, people that join the military, especially people that go into special forces, you know, Delta Force, Recon, Navy SEALs, Rangers. These are people who don't run away from fire. They run into fire.
You ever watch Black Hawk Down? Look at how they went back in there. Men lost their lives trying to make sure that no man was left behind. And not just in special forces. You talk to my son who was infantry army. And these guys would pack it on, wounded or not, and go in there to save people's lives, even if it cost them their life. This is what makes America great. And there were, you know, you heard that guy said that colonel said to him, this is the first time that a bureaucrat or, you know, whatever they call him, but a bureaucrat has more balls than somebody in the military because they were told to stand down when he was trying to get a second group of people to go in. You know, it's beyond. Now, here's the thing. If we erupt some kind of war situation in the Middle East, I mean, during the Bush era, not, you know, there's issues I have with the Bush era, but we also had the attacks. And a lot of our youth jumped up, patriotic youth, and joined the military, my son included. Mm-hmm. With the crap that's gone on in the last 4 years and the way that our military, our vets are being treated, you know, all the suicides, the pulling the benefits, all this kind of stuff, you think that if we get in a war situation under this current administration with the way the military's been treated in foreign situations, Benghazi, Afghanistan, all these situations, including how our veterans are treated back here, you think you're going to have, you know, 500,000 guys jump up and go, yeah, I want to go fight for my country?
Better.
I mean, this stuff is mainstream, man.
are you suggesting this, that this leading from behind strategy doesn't inspire people to fight? You know, look, politicians, you know, Ozzy Osbourne said it, you know, 40 years ago, you know, politicians start the war, but they don't go out to fight. Okay. So, you know, look, I think it's important in our system to have civilian control of our military assets. I think that's important. I think that the president being commander in chief, perhaps not this one, but general, the office of the president being commander in chief is a smart idea. Having the militia of the several states be the general peacetime force, and then having, you know, the Navy and the Marines, I think that's a good idea. But look, the simple fact is that you can't inspire people into battle for bullshit reasons and treating them badly. You know, Americans traditionally, you know, barring, you know, the whole drug culture of the 60s, generally speaking, Americans love and support their military. Mm-hmm. But we've never been the kind of people who want to support an imperial foreign adventure force. We support a defensive force. Now, that does not mean that you don't deploy overseas. Let's be clear about something. Thomas Jefferson first deployed our Marines overseas. Guess where?
Yeah,
oh, that's
where,
right.
Where did he deploy them?
Libya. He sent them
to Libya
from the shores of Tripoli, you know, to the shores of Tripoli. So, and it was to fight Muslim pirates, okay? So sometimes you do need to go overseas even in a defensive situation, but you don't inspire people to do that when you're lying about it, when you are funneling weapons, intelligence, and support to what is essentially the enemy, or at least somebody who we don't know is friendly, and then when you treat people like crap when they come back home. And when I say that, it's, you know, you drug them so that you can numb their minds, they're committing suicide, you're not giving them the help that they need, you're letting the VA hospitals fall apart. You know, this is
people
not
dying,
the way,
right?
Yeah, this is not the way you do it. But you see, when you view life with such little regard, and I mean, we see it, okay? You got this psycho in Cleveland that kidnapped those girls 10 years ago, kept them prisoner. You got the Gosnell trial where this guy is just committing all sorts of atrocities. It's not getting any coverage.
No news.
You know, when you have this little regard for life, when you have a, quote, you know, health care bill that rations care and has what Sarah Palin aptly called death panels, then, you know, you look at soldiers not as people and patriots who are fighting to defend their country and their way of life, but you just look at them as military assets that you do with whatever you want. They're like pawns in a chessboard, and that's the problem. You can't, and if you don't have an inspired, resolute, well-trained military force, you don't have a country. Ultimately, the reason Rome fell was because of the corrupt immorality of their culture, but what that led to was diminishing warrior capacity, and they were overrun by the barbarians.
You can't
defend yourself. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, not just that, but they ended up having to hire mercenaries, and you know, because they depleted the, you know, the citizens. And mercenary armies, you know, they fight for money. Shit gets tough. Yep. They get, you know, they split. I mean, there's a lot of dynamics to patriotism, which has been bred out of our country the last 40, 50 years. But, you know, that's what makes a country great. You know, is patriotism. It's that extra mile that wins and loses wars. Sorry, go ahead.
No,
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, the important thing to understand is, what is patriotism? I mean, patriotism is a virtue. And patriotism comes from the word patria, which in Latin is, you know, of the father. So it's, you know, of the fatherland. It is love of country. And what we have been replacing patriotism with is either, you know, it's important to be self-critical. In fact, as an American, especially in light of the way the Founding Fathers helped us develop our government, it is incumbent upon us to distrust our government, not to hate our government. We're not anti-government. We're just anti-corrupt government. We love the Constitution, and that is actually a government-creating document. So clearly you can't love the Constitution and be anti-government. But you distrust the government because you know it's run by corrupt men. And that's the tradition that we have. So you don't just give power to elected representatives and then leave them to do whatever they want, because we know that power attracts the corrupt. But the simple fact is that we're replacing patriotism with either, instead of a healthy self-criticism, a hatred for America. And there are people who constantly display this hatred for America. And what they typically point to is the dastardly actions of certain elements in our federal government, and they blame the country, which is incorrect. Or that there's blind nationalism and jingoism. And nationalism is love of government as opposed to love of country. And that's the difference. Patriots love their country. Fascists love their government. And leftist anarchists, I guess, just hate government in general. So, you know, the proper balance is love your country. You need a government. We have a form for our government. But you don't trust it. In other words, you don't just let it alone and say, oh, they know what they're doing. They'll take care of it, which we've been doing for so long, which is why we've gone so far down this road, which is precisely why crap like Benghazi happens. Because if you were keeping an eye on these bastards, something like this wouldn't happen.
Well, exactly. I mean, look, this goes back to you're doing a second wrong in order to correct the first wrong that we committed, I guess. After World War II, you know, every opponent that we have is immediately Hitler. They're undeterrable. And so we have to be forward deployed overseas all the time in order to stop the advance of communism, right? So that's a defensive posture, ostensibly a defensive posture. But when you have a bipolar world order, every minor conflict on the planet, just as happened during the Peloponnesian War between the Athenians and the Spartans, every minor conflict gets caught up in the larger conflict between the two major powers, because there are two camps, and a gain for one side is automatically a loss for the other side. Now, Tito and others tried to do the non-aligned movement with some marginal degrees of success, but largely it didn't work. So when you're looking at the Middle East and policy in the Middle East, well, they had a major resource that we needed, and the Soviets knew that we needed it, and so they went and they were, you know, funding people in the Middle East. We were funding people in the Middle East, and it's easier to control a country from the outside if you have a strong man. And so we went and we set up strong men, and the Soviets were setting up strong men too. Certainly weren't bothered about setting up parliamentary democracies, because God knows those are way too complex. So we'll set up all these dictatorships over there, or we will support ones that are friendly to us anyway if we're not outright setting them up. We'll certainly support them, and then we won't bother about the problems that are going on internally in the country. And then over time, you get to situations where the people there are like, you know, what's with these Americans? You know, they have, you know, freedom and democracy in their country, but yet they're supporting, you know, these tyrannies here in our country. They're at least not saying anything about it. And, you know, these guys are, you know, if you look at Iran with SABIC and all those other, you know, the secret police that the Iranians had, you know, if you lived there at the time, you certainly wouldn't be too happy with us. So now, after 9/11, we go back, okay, well, we don't have to do that anymore. Now we can, you know, lead to the spreading of democracy and all this other kind of stuff. And you're going back and you're just trying to fix a prior thing. Stop. Leave them alone. You know, I mean, just leave them alone at a certain point. Let them figure it out, right? And if they start causing problems, they start, you know, coming over, or they start, you know, building up militaries and getting, you know, some kind of capacity where they could do something, okay, then go shut that down if it becomes a threat. But otherwise, you know, you don't need to be involved in everyone's everyday life as to what they're doing over there. And that's what breeds the resentment, and that's what leads them to come over here. Just quit messing around with them. Why do we got to stick our nose in every problem? I mean, God, look at the problems we have here in this country that we can't solve. Well, we're going to solve problems in a country we know little to nothing about, or that we have a handful of,
we're getting ready to import 20,
to work on it.
20 million new ones. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the conceit. How many people are working on the problems in those countries who actually understand them in depth, in a practical sense, and not just in an academic sense over there, that they know what they're doing? I mean, how many experts do we have in these countries?
I would argue that probably not many. I'm pretty sure that the people that live in the Middle East don't understand the Middle East, let alone outsiders. You know, Reagan once said, he goes, the Middle East isn't the place. It's a state of mind, a disordered state of mind. So why are you poking around in it? It does, you know, obviously it's because there's resources that the corporatist Keynesians who've kind of, you know, absconded with our government want to plunder. And, you know, they don't care what it costs in the way of American lives, treasure, and debt, and they don't care what it does to the people over there, especially since the people who tend to be the ones that get screwed the most over there are the tribal minorities and mostly the Christians. And you know, for Americans, whether you're, you know, a Christian believer or not is not the point. The fact is that this nation was founded through Western civilization, which is traditionally Christian, and the people who are in the lands where Christianity was first established, where the church began. You know, here we are, you know, celebrating Pentecost in the next week, and that's when the church started. They're the people who are getting screwed the most. How do you profess to be a Christian nation when what your policies are doing is jeopardizing Christians globally, and especially in the Middle East, where the faith got its start? And that's also true for Judaism, because these things tend to engender a hostility towards Jews and Israel, and then, you know, then we get the whole Islamophobe thing over here. I mean, I don't know who's afraid of Muslims. It's just a different religion. It's not necessarily one we agree with, but, you know, we do have a First Amendment. People can practice freely. The real problem is when the religion, as opposed to expressing itself in the public square, decides that it wants to become the political arm, and that's the fundamental problem with Sharia law. And Newt Gingrich aptly said it this week, I think. He said that this issue of Sharia law is a battle that we're going to face for the next 70 years. You cannot have Sharia law and the U.S. Constitution, because the two things are incompatible. That First Amendment, which is really the core and crux of the American experiment in self-government.
You could have it over in their place. They can do what they want to do, you know, but you can't have it here in the U.S. and still have,
exactly,
you know, the Constitution and Bill of Rights, but in their country, they can do their thing.
And we shouldn't be dictating to them what they should do over there. That's between, you know, them and their leadership and their culture. But
they
got to
live the consequences of their decision. Well,
let me ask you a crazy. Let me ask you a crazy question. I remember back in the day, years ago, everybody was always up in arms about human rights and women's suffrage. Why is it that the left is embracing a group of people that want to take women back to the 4th and 5th century? It absolutely blows me away.
Well, you know, it's actually a very interesting point, probably a huge topic in and of itself, but in simple terms, I would argue that the leftist mentality, okay, is
a lie.
But it's so out of touch with reality that they accuse us of being reactionary. You know, conservatives are reactionary. They're always trying to take things back, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, maybe that's the Republican position to be reactionary, but a conservative position is to actually stand for something, not necessarily just against something. And what they fail to realize is that in their desire to take out the traditional, the orthodox, the conservative, they'll use any means necessary and make allies with those of their enemies. I mean, look, it's very simple. The Nazis did the same thing. The Soviets did the same thing. It is the fallacy of the collectivist leftist mentality. And so if they perceive Islam as a threat to, quote, you know, Christian, social, constitutional conservatives, whatever that broad spectrum is, then they'll align with them. What they don't realize is that all of their, quote, liberal principles are completely derided by Islam, and once they gain power, they'll just turn on them. And the fact is that if you line them up, you've got really three major camps with various colors in the spectrums in the world right now vying for dominance. And you basically have the kind of the traditional conservative view of our rights come from God and governments are instituted to protect them. You have this liberal view that man can perfect himself if we simply have the right experts running the show. And then you got the Islamist view, which is that, you know, a bureaucratic socialist Muslim theocracy is the best solution. And anybody that doesn't want to fall into the fold of Dar al-Islam, which is the house of peace, falls outside the fold into Dar al-Harb, which is the house of war, and they have to either be eradicated or subjugated. So that's why they line up. But it is a huge fallacy, a terrible mistake, and committed liberals, people that are committed to true liberal principles of free expression, free speech, autonomy, that kind of thing, they cannot ally themselves with these far extremist radical jihadists. It just doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. Well, you know, look, even in our own history, okay, so this is sort of the conceit of people in power, that they somehow, they see further, they know better, they're having that tete-a-tete with the burning bush that the rest of us can't see, and they're going to come back and they're going to speak for you, the unwashed, idiotic, you know, masses, and tell you what to do, right? They can't do that here. I mean, look what's been going on with this country since, you know, we started trying to do this. The thing's going downhill, right? So now you have this small body of experts that can somehow from a distance read some book, glean some footnote that I guess nobody ever saw that footnote, and then now they can run, you know, Libya, they can fix the Middle East from afar. I mean, for God's sake, no, they can't. You know, what if somebody over in Egypt is like, oh, I know how to run America. You know, you got like 50 dudes over there like, hey, I could run the United States, you know. They got this constitution thing going. We'll sit down in a room, we'll have a bunch of meetings, we'll drink a lot of tea, and then, you know, we can figure out the United States problem and how to solve it. Doesn't work that way. And we've tried this before, in a way, if you look at the French Revolution, because during the American Revolution, we had to go over to France and Europe and try to get funding. And we went over there, and Benjamin Franklin and John Jay and all these other people, you know, we sent over there as our ambassadors. They started talking the principles of liberty to everybody. And part of that is what kicked off the French Revolution. And we were appalled by the French Revolution. So we're over there trying to apply our principles and everything to the situation of, you know, the age of absolutism, France. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I think we've got it. You know, freedom, egality, liberté, you know, fraternity. And then, yeah, and then next thing you know, they're like lopping each other's heads. I was like, whoa, I don't think you got it, you know. And look what they went through. So this is like an early experiment that we did in this. You know, it's really kind of the conceit that we have after World War II, where we, you know, actually did have some successes there. But why did you really have success? Well, you basically bombed the population down to nothing, you know, and when they crawled out of the rubble, like, hey, whatever, you know, we don't want to go back to war again, you know, let's just build a productive society and, you know, I don't know, I'll go work in a factory and then maybe I won't have to die, you know, maybe. And so it's a completely different mindset. But to sit there and think that you can be a puppet master of everything without the compliance or the will or the desire of the people there to make that kind of change is just absurd. And it doesn't work, as you can clearly see.
Well, and I think there's another factor to add in that text is the corruption. When you send billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, to people that you want to prop up and they misuse those funds, you're not gaining democracy. You know,
no,
you're creating corruption. You're creating, you know, we fund drug lords. We fund, you know, murderers. And I mean, what we're doing is we're setting up environments that are absolutely the direct opposite of what it is that we claim democracy is. And we fund these bastards. We're not helping
them. And the problem with democracy is you're going to get what the bulk of the people want. And if the people are relatively impoverished and uneducated and are used to basically being ruled by a strong man, they're going to gravitate towards who the strongest is. I mean, look, you got this Arab Spring, right? So you end up with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. You end up with you know, they're trying to tell us that, you know, this whole Benghazi thing is about proving that, you know, after we got rid of Gaddafi, Libya was stable, which is a friggin' lie. Tunisia, Morocco are just as chaotic. You got all this problem going on in the Emirate States, and they're clamping down on people. And when our Western media was actually reporting accurately on it, those reporters were told to shut up, and they were fired in silence. So, and now we're doing the same thing in Syria. You cannot impose what us essentially 800 to 1,000 years to aspire to and superimpose it onto a culture that's not ready for it. You have to have them find their own way and develop their own systems. Now, we can help them, and the fact is that we're supposed to help them, okay? But that means that if you have an affinity for Christians overseas or you want to evangelize, then you know what? That's the mission. You do private missionary work voluntarily, okay? And if you are setting up a business, you go over there and you show them our business methods and how markets work, because it's good for trade. There's voluntary ways of reaching out to people and bringing them up to a level. You don't impose it at the end of a gun. That never, ever works. All it does is create massive blowback. Now, if your interest is to go plunder resources under the guise of a humanitarian mission, well, then, you know, you're going about it the right way. Of course, you're going to have, quote, collateral damage on both sides of unprecedented proportions. But, hey, you know what? That just might engender more of a security state, which is really
but
good
you know
for
what?
You if you're the one financing
Rex,
it.
We don't even do the resources thing well. I mean, we went and poured all of our money into Iraq and didn't even get the oil contracts. I mean, you know, we can't even do that right.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think the people that were, the jingoists behind the war in the first place, they got the oil contract. It's just that these United States didn't get it.
Bingo, yeah. Well, but
and
I'm,
that's
you
the
know
problem.
What I'm saying.
We have
yeah.
a parasite that has taken over our government and is imposing this neocon foreign policy that is not good for America. Certainly not good for the countries we're invading, but it is very good for business for a certain few connected people. We're at the top of the hour. Call in number is 646-649-1013. That's 646-649-1013. You're live with Tex and Rex and Chris from Coalition of Freedom on Facebook. Please go to our Facebook page, the Tex and Rex Show. Like the page, and you will get notifications of our broadcast times, generally 10 p.m. Eastern Sundays. And also feel free to join the Tex and Rex Liberty Militia, where we have clips, videos, and articles from things we're talking about. Tonight's topic, Benghazi, bend over, Ben Lyon. Someone's been lying about Benghazi, and they're forcing you to bend over and take it. So call in, tell us what's on your mind. What are you pissed off about the lies? What's got you concerned about what's going on? And what are you going to do to stand up and fight it? Call the number, 646-649-1013. You know, guys, there is somebody who has been out there fighting it, and he actually called Hillary Clinton out specifically by name, and I think that was really cool. Now, some people will say that, you know, it's political posturing because she might be his number one opponent coming up in 2016, blah, 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 but, you know, I got to say something that generally speaking, look, all politicians have to do a little bit of politicking and marketing. They all got to play the game when they get into office. It's just it's a dirty, filthy town here, and if you're not playing the game, you know, you're not getting far. But there are people who look at public office not as a way of self-enriching and self-aggrandizement, but they do look at it as an office of service. A lot of them get corrupt along the way. A lot of them are corrupt to begin with. But there are a few examples, and I would say in recent history, the biggest example the world has seen for an American politician with principles is Dr. Ron Paul. And it seems that his son has, you know, imbibed upon those principles of liberty. And he was in Iowa. This is a minute 30, Rand Paul talking about Benghazi.
Now, I got on the Foreign Affairs Committee this year, and so I got to ask Hillary Clinton a few questions. I didn't get finished, so I've still got a few. We'll hopefully get them relayed to the media to her. First question for Hillary Clinton, where in the hell were the Marines? And you know what her answer is? Her answer is, oh, the Marines are to guard the paper. And I said, look, I know a lot of Marines, and I think they can do more than guard paper. She said, well, that's the rule. They're to guard the paper, not the personnel. I said, well, they don't do that in Baghdad. The point is that Benghazi is a lot more like Baghdad than it is Paris. We did a review board of all of this, and there were a lot of mistakes made maybe at the time, after the time. There's all this, you know, cover-up and this and that. But what's always been most important to me is what happened in the 6 months leading up to this. Because there's no excuse in the 6 months leading up to this when your people on the ground, military people and State Department people, are asking for more help. They're asking for security. They're pleading for security, and they got nothing. It was inexcusable. It was a dereliction of duty, and it should preclude her from holding higher office.
Where the hell were the Marines? Good question.
Well, you know, and that really is the big mystery. Okay, so let's say that Paula Broadwell was right, that it was some sort of rendition facility over there, or, you know, prison for people that were of interest. Why would you not send the air support over there to go support that? You know, why would you? Because presumably if a thing gets overrun, it's going to be discovered that that's what it is, right? So why would you not send the support? And really, I don't have a good answer to that. My understanding is the people who lost their lives, they lost their lives because they were painting lasers on mortar positions. Well, you don't go paint lasers on a mortar position if you don't think that there's an airplane in the air that is there to support you. So was there one there and it was ordered not to fire? Or were they lied to and told that there was one there and there wasn't?
Well, the interesting thing is you're just a brown coat with a microphone, so I don't expect you to have any answers. But there are people who should have answers. Why don't they?
Well, and the other thing, too, exactly. And I don't know if you guys listened to the whole hearing, but, you know, they talked about they had X amount of people, and they were going, you know, this is a hot area, and we need more support. And their version of more support was to take 10 of those military personnel away. They left them in an extremely vulnerable position. They pulled troops out. Now, this is prior. You know, when everybody, including all the security guys, you know, the guys that were in the hearing, you know, this is their expertise, and they're going, we need more support, and their solution was to take away more support. So when the attack happened, they were way undermanned. And then secondary is, you know, what the hell are you doing in a volatile situation that's been full of, you know, revolutions and wars and suicide bombing and, you know, disruption and chaos, and not have your rapid response systems in place? That's just mind-boggling. And then there's that part way back when Benghazi first happened where that Army general and that Navy admiral both got ousted, and nobody's mm-hmm. talking about that, but a lot of top-level people, and I have a feeling mm-hmm. these people were, like, trying to do their damn job. And they got in a riff with the administration. He said, no, we're going to let them die. You know, maybe they didn't say it that way, but you know what I'm saying. When you don't support people in a firefight, they're going to die, you know. Well, and so
maybe
I have a feeling that this thing is deep, man, and it's got to get uncovered.
Maybe the skills required to do community organizing don't translate too well to being commander-in-chief. I'm just saying.
And maybe all the corruption that's going on and all the backroom deals and all the bull crap in politics is collapsing on us. We're not doing what we're supposed to be doing.
This exact same type of thing happened in Somalia when they were saying, hey, look, you know, the equipment that we have is substandard. You know, we need to have tanks here for this mission. And they're like, no, we don't want to send tanks because that's going to represent some sort of escalation of conflict. You just go ahead and you guys do it with what you have and you do it on the cheap and you end up in this Black Hawk Down type situation. And, you know, now they're saying, well, we don't send people into a firefight unless we know exactly what's going on. Well, were you sending anyone there to figure out what was going on? Not really. You had some drones on the scene. And second, you've got special forces guys. Those guys go out all the time. They don't know what the full situation is. That's what they're trained to do. You don't know the situation. Assess it when you get there and take care of this thing. You know? So that, once again, we're doing the same thing. You know, not having a mission and not supporting what the mission is. If you did have, I mean, the ambassador is over there. Okay, so there's some reason that he was over there. The ambassador is in trouble. They're asking for help to assist the ambassador. Maybe you have a facility there that's also under assault that you may or may not want anybody to know that you have. And there's a problem. Everybody's like, let's not do anything. Why? Why was that decision made? It doesn't make any sense.
CYA, the first rule of bureaucrats is to cover your own ass as opposed to worry about doing the right thing. That's the fundamental problem. And the fact...
the first thing to do would be to cover your own ass. Wouldn't covering your ass be to go send something over there, just a C-130 to go spin around in a circle and just start shooting stuff? I mean, that's what I don't get. That the action that people are taking with CYA.
How many people have we lost in Afghanistan in really stupid situations in the last couple of years that the news doesn't even report on?
Too many.
I mean, it's just insane.
But the news was reporting on the news was the death toll every single day when Bush was
president. Oh, you know, if any of this stuff happened under a Republican, it'd be 24/7. 24/7. You know, but as much as I dislike Republicans too, you know, they take care of their military. You know.
Well, sometimes some of them are more interested in ginning up the military to be an imperialist force, which is not what we're supposed to be. And the fact is
I'm talking about combat.
Yeah, we talked about it last time, and that is that, you know, and Reagan said it clearly, peace through strength. If you're ready to kick everybody's ass, generally people don't screw with you. But if you run around breaking your force, actually trying to kick everybody's ass, they realize that you have a weakness, and they get a little pissed off, and you put people's lives in danger. And the fact is our military has always reacted to these situations by improving. I mean, the entire concept of the SEALs was originally the UDT teams in World War II, you know, because they had to break apart all the works that the Germans had built, you know, for the expeditionary forces to hit the beachheads. And then that developed into the SEAL program. And then we had the Iran hostage situation, right? And it was a Jimmy Carter pooch screw. There was a sandstorm. They were ill-prepared. It was a terribly executed mission. People died, and it was a terribly dark day. Well, from that gross mistake, that gross negligence and natural circumstances, was born SEAL Team 6. And Dick Marcinko was the one who put this together. This was the anti-terrorist Jedi Knights elite of the elite. And we've now expanded that program, and it is the kind of warfare you're facing when you don't have a balanced superpower geopolitical game of risk going on with the Soviets, where you have more fluid insurgencies
and things,
so that's the model that went. But even when that happens, and the fact is that you talk to the right people. So SEAL Team 6 was developed by people like Dick Marcinko, who knew what was going on at the ground level and how to execute these things in spec warfare. But then the bureaucrats get a hold of it, and they want to use it for alternate purposes. So you start retasking these things. You start screwing with them. You know, the 1982 bombing at the Beirut airport, where we lost several hundred Marines, the guys at SEAL Team 6 knew that that was an exposure. They knew that it was dangerous. They knew that Hezbollah was likely to do something like this. They tried to get them to do something about it, and again, a failure of leadership occurred. And I'm not putting this on Reagan necessarily, because I believe that his administration was infiltrated by neocons. Why do you think they stuck him with George, Eat My Shorts, Bush as his vice president? Those guys didn't like each other. And so we ended up with this terrible situation. What was the reaction that the politicians took to the bombing in Beirut? We didn't go after Hezbollah. We got out of Beirut. What you tell an enemy like extreme Muslim jihadists when you do something like that is, hey, if you hit them where it hurts, they leave.
Yeah,
which is why you still have problems in Afghanistan, and you still have problems in Iraq,
Africa.
And why you will continue to have problems in Africa, and why you will continue to have problems in Syria if you step up what is already an illegal war that we're involved in there through NATO and the UN by going full force. And now they're playing this stupid game, and this all funnels through Benghazi, which is, I believe, what triggered the whole exposure here. But they play this stupid game now where they're saying, oh, okay, well, it seems that the major force that's drawing all the other, quote, Syrian fighters is affiliated with Al-Qaeda. We want to label them as terrorists, and what we want to do is not support them. But there are other, quote, rebel forces there to support. Just because you're not affiliated with Al-Qaeda does not mean that you're not interested in establishing a Muslim jihadi state under Sharia law. And right now there's a city in Syria, I think it's called Raqqa, where the black flag of Al-Qaeda flies above the Syrian flag.
Mm-hmm.
Obama, you built that. That's ridiculous. Now, Assad, not a great guy, right? But he's the Syrians guy. That's their guy. That's the regime that they're under. There's definitely problems. They could work on it. But the chaos that's been created by what's going on over there with foreigners from 29 countries and this collateral damage of tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of refugees and all the killings and the death, this is not the solution, and we're up to our ears in it, and that is a bad thing. So I think that this Benghazi issue has to be pressed. People have to be held accountable. I don't care if it goes all the way to the top. Now, realistically speaking, there's going to be no impeachment. They're not going to go after Obama. Boehner is such a pussy, and John McCain and Lindsey Graham don't want to jeopardize their,
They just want more war anyway.
Right, so they're not going to jeopardize that. But Hillary's had my role, and that's just fine with me because I think she's up to her ears in it. But what's important here is that this is going to be up to principled senators and congressmen to deal with, and it's going to require your support. So when they're doing these things, call and tell them that you want the truth, you want this exposed. It's very important that we get to the bottom of this because it is – potentially a blight on all of us, and the fact is that if you're going to dispatch people in the foreign service across the world, which we should, because that's how you establish trade, that's how you keep good relations with other people, mm-hmm. It is important to have embassies. You don't send your people to foreign countries and leave them exposed and in danger, okay? So, there is a certain function for the federal government. It is enumerated. It is required. They're failing to do it, and they're screwing up and doing everything that they shouldn't be doing. We're sitting here worried about the Jordanian, Syrian, Iraqi border. We got a border to our south that is a sieve that is bringing in disease, terrorists, and welfare recipients that we can't afford. Why don't we work on that problem? So everything is upside down and backwards, but it's only going to continue if you allow it. So you've got to get in there, and you've got to tell them that you want these things corrected, that you want them to do the right thing. Call in number 646-649-1013. Let's hear from you about Benghazi. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to add one thing before we get off Syria, and I don't know, is Tex on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, all right. I just hadn't heard you for a while. But I just want to add one more thing on the Syria thing.
Rex was on a tear, so...
Yeah, you were so
sometimes
quiet there.
Sometimes
he
gets on a tear, it's hard to interject. Anyway, go ahead.
But this thing about Syria is that 90% of what you hear on the news about who's doing who to what in Syria is a lie. Don't buy into that crap. Do your own research. You know, who's killing who and who's abusing who and who's using chemical weapons. It's all bull crap. They're trying to pin everything on the Assad regime. And I'm not, kissing his rear end and saying he's a wonderful guy, but I don't like lies. They're trying to pin it down just to force it, boots on the ground by Americans. And they're using a lie to do it, so don't believe it. Go ahead, Tex.
Yeah. Isn't one of the groups that we're supporting basically accused of using chemical weapons and... they have ties to Al Qaeda. Anyway, I'll shut up.
They tried to say it was Assad, and UN went in and said it's not Assad. It was the Freedom Fighters, freedom, quote unquote. Go ahead.
Well, think of it this way, right? Let's just say that you're Assad, right? Okay, you're an Alawite, which means you're a tribal minority in Syria. Everybody tends to think, it's Syria, so everybody there is Syrian. Well, yeah, nationally they're Syrian, but ethnically and religiously they're tribal, so it's completely different. The Alawites are a minority. The Ba'ath Party, quote, the only party that, runs elections and keeps winning, is the party in power, but they tend, to keep things rather balanced. Now, think of it this way, right? If you're allegedly the party in power that's supposed to be keeping stability in Syria, and you've got these foreign invaders coming in to, fight against you, and it's not like that they pick a field of battle and say, hey, we're here to take over your country, meet us on the field of battle, and the victor go the spoils. These guys intentionally infiltrate civilian areas so that when you have to strike back at them, there's going to be civilian damage. And you know this as the regime. So do you think that it would be a politically astute or even tactically smart move, despite the respect or loss of life, would it be smart to actually use chemical weapons in those areas, which essentially means that you're actually going to hit civilians and probably engender more hostility towards you? I mean, the only reason that this thing's taken 2 years and why Assad hasn't fallen yet is because most Syrians prefer him to these foreigners. Now,
because
that doesn't mean they like
are.
Him. Yeah, it doesn't mean that they like him, but he's kind of the devil that you know, and things are relatively stable. You could get food, you could get health care. If you're a Christian, you go to church. So, you know, maybe you don't speak ill of the government. Maybe you don't say too loudly, I don't like what Assad did. Okay, that's not an ideal situation, but at least you can eat. You can, your kids can go to school. You can get health care, and you can worship. Okay, now you're living in a war zone, and you don't know who's friend or foe because there's all these foreigners in there, and you're getting all these mixed messages and all these kinds of setups. I mean, there was this bombing in Turkey. Sure, they're trying to blame it on the Syrians. Well, it's already been relatively proven that that was kind of a setup, and it's probably one of these, quote, foreign rebel forces. So it's a very confusing situation. It's hard to know it even when you're there, okay? So how are we going to get it right? We're going to end up on the wrong side any way that you cut it. We shouldn't be involved, and that's
yeah.
the fundamental problem.
Yeah, well, so this al-Nusra Front, which is the backbone of our Syrian opposition, basically back in April, declared its openly swore loyalty to al-Qaeda. I would say that's a bad sign for how the policy would be going. I would say that was a strong negative indicator of how things might be doing over there with our whole policy.
Yep.
Anyway.
Very subtle.
So, yeah, Syria, we're talking about sending weapons over there and getting more deeply involved. I can't wait. It sounds like a wonderful place. I know there's a lot of Roman ruins there that I've always wanted to see. And perhaps, you know, someone will go over there soon and they'll get to tour these things and have a wonderful, fantastic time during their Syrian visit to this hellhole. Anyway.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind is we're looking at this thing, at this Syrian thing, in relation to the cover up in Benghazi and the potential weapons and people running. Well, let's also take it a step further. It's not about Syria. I mean,
no.
Assad. First of all, let's keep in mind a couple of things. This is not Hafez Assad. This is Bashar Assad, his son. They basically made him president because of the name recognition, you know, the lineage of his father, but it's the Ba'ath regime that is in place. This guy is a Western-trained ophthalmologist who had a practice in London, okay? I suspect one of the last things he wanted to do was go back and run Syria, but, you know, it was kind of impressed upon him. Okay, fine. Is he a bad guy? Is he not a bad guy? I don't know, and I don't care. You know, that's the Syrians' problem. Let them figure it out. But the fact is that this is not about toppling him. He's been there for a few years. Why all of a sudden do we want to topple him? Well, it kind of came upon the wave of the Arab Spring, which was essentially triggered by our invasion of Iraq and then all the leftist fomenting of this, you know, revolutionary ideal. And, oh, they're going to get freedom and everything's going to be wonderful. Even Bush, stupid as he was, you know, wanted democratic elections in Gaza. Well, who won that election? Oh, that's right. It was Hamas, a terrorist organization. And then we complain about it. Well, you asked for it. You know, stop pushing things and then getting the wrong result and then going in there to blow it up because it didn't work out your way. Just leave it alone. We got enough problems here. And so they're covering this up. But what's really the end game here? Well, it's not Syria. It wasn't even really Iraq. It's
no.
Iran. It's Iran.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole thing.
That's where we're going.
Out of Iran.
Well,
yeah,
you saw that.
Those, yeah.
I mean, you notice we're kind of all around that place. Every country that surrounds them, we're in, you know, we're all over the place. And believe me, if you don't believe it, the Iranians sure do, because they're looking at their borders like, we got these guys, they're everywhere. They're all over us. You know, they're freaking out. And now their number one sort of ally in the Middle East is Syria. We're all over that, too. And they're like, man, this is not looking good for us. And we have our, you know, which... completely legitimate, our complaint that they're using the nuclear power program as a cover for nuclear weapons, which they are, you know, but that's sort of the justification that we have for going in, and they're just like, you know, the writing's on the wall for this thing. When are we going to, what are we going to do about it?
Well, let's just say
so
that they are getting a nuke.
It's been about Iran for a long time.
Yeah, but let's just say they are getting a nuke, which real intelligence says that they're quite a bit away from. And, I mean, look, building a nuclear weapon ain't the easiest thing in the world, okay? But let's say that they are building a nuke. Why are we so freaked out about Iran having a nuke? Pakistan has a nuke. They just had elections where, like, you know, people were being killed because of their election. They have, like, you know, they have nukes. They have, like, 100 nukes, okay? India has nukes, and the Pakistanis and the Indians, they don't only dislike each other, they despise each other, okay? They're, I mean, they might launch missiles tomorrow, right? Why are we so freaked out about Iran with their potential nuke when we know that North Korea has them or is developing them? We know that Pakistan and India have them, and they don't get along, and Pakistan isn't exactly, you know, the most
stable
place, okay?
Yeah,
you know,
who
we're
really
actually
runs
at,
Pakistan.
You know, we're at war in Pakistan from Afghanistan.
Well,
and at any
Iran's
moment, if they
running around talking about using them all the time, which is a big problem, I would say. And also, strictly speaking, yes, you know, India and Pakistan did get nuclear weapons, but you really want to keep the group of people who have them fairly limited. And in the case of North Korea, we found out essentially when it was too late. Now, did we really find out when it was too late, or did we just through inertia just sort of let the thing happen? Which, if you look at what's going on with Iran, it's sort of like through inertia we're letting it happen. But, you know, once they've got one, you know, it kind of creates a lot of problems.
Yeah, yeah, but
Rodman they have a delivery system.
Yeah, you know, but Rodman fixed Korea, so we're cool there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Rodman just said, "Hey, Kim, man. Don't point the missiles at us." And Kim's like, "All right, Dennis Rodman said don't do it," so he pulled the missiles.
Sure.
I mean, talk about what kind of crazy fucking diplomacy we got in this country when we got the Secretary of State, the former First Lady, who's covering up Benghazi. We got a wingnut like Dennis Rodman causing Kim to back down.
Get that dude some tattoos, get him a gold grill, you know, shoot some hoops, or do some Mongolian barbecue. Next thing you know, he's dating Madonna, and all of a sudden he loves the West. You know, so.
Unbelievable.
But look, you have to ask yourself this. Is it really nukes that we're worried about? Because let's be clear about something.
No.
If the Iranians are developing a nuke, you don't have to go to war to stop them. I mean, how hard is it to get in there and kill a few scientists, hack a few computers, blow up a few facilities? I mean, come on, be real.
They got the guys on little mopeds driving by and sticking bombs on cars and then cycling off.
We have the bunker busters. We've got $250 million freaking fighter jets. We can, you know, laser you from outer space. This is all bullshit. You look at Iran. You know that map that I posted on my group and that with the articles below it? The problem with most people is they look at the Middle East, they're looking at the south end, you know, the south end of Iraq and our buddy Saudi Arabia.
The Gulf.
You know, you're looking down below. What you need to do is you need to tip your map, your Google map, up and look at the north end. Look at where Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan all merge into the belly going up into the, you know, Kazakhstan, up through the Caucasus into the belly of Russia. That's what you got to look at, because there's your future. You know, they're already doing this caucus thing. You know, you're getting all these articles coming out. You know, the bottom line is those, you know, those are the pathways that Russia wanted when they were the empire builder, trying to come down through the Caucasus and down through, you know, Kazakhstan into Afghanistan. They were trying to build that pathway south, and, you know, they hit these tribal regions, and of course they hit some big mountains too, but, you know, they couldn't, it broke the country, and we're turning around moving, and we're moving right back through that crap. We're trying to move into it.
You said the caucus strategy. That's what Ron Paul did, right?
Yeah.
What, is that how Ron Paul got to Tampa, through the caucuses?
So that's how you get to Delaware, is that caucus strategy.
Yeah. The caucus something.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, the really interesting thing is that this is ultimately, the root of this always goes back to the progressive era. It goes back to Keynesianism. It goes back to corporatism. And it always ends up squarely at the foot of the Federal Reserve scheme, because they decoupled the dollar from gold. You got it backed by, quote, petrodollar. So you got this alliance with Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. You know, we invaded Iraq the first time, you know, with George Eat My Shorts Bush on behalf of the Qatari Emirate and the Saudis, and that's what kind of pissed off bin Laden from being a anti-Soviet freedom fighter to being, you know, refocusing on the infidel that has their new crusader fleet, you know, on our sacred lands and all that stuff. And it all comes down to the very simple fact that if your money is unstable, then the only thing that you can do is back it up by some other commodity, which is ostensibly oil, right? And the only way that you can enforce that when you're not using your own oil is through your military power. That's coming to an end. 42 years of playing this game, it's gone so far, it's collapsing around our ears, and so Iran has to be a target because those bastards have the audacity to set up an energy exchange not denominated in USFRN. Now, there's a simple solution out of this whole mess. You got to eradicate this thing. It's up for its renewal of its charter this year. Call your congressman. Paul Braun introduced an audit the Fed and end the Fed bill in the Congress. Senator Rand Paul introduced it in the Senate. Get people behind this thing, because if you can eliminate this thing, we have, and Tex can talk about this, we have energy in this country like you wouldn't believe. If our infrastructure wasn't so bogged down by bureaucracy and could actually get up to speed to deliver this stuff, we would become a net exporter of energy. The price of fuel would go down dramatically, and therefore the price of just about everything in your economy would drop. And if you stabilize your dollar by backing it to a real commodity, you would actually have stable and probably declining prices, which puts the fear of God into guys like helicopter Ben Bernanke, but it's actually for you if your income is being diminished when the prices of goods go down. And you start importing this stuff, you will actually become a very wealthy and prosperous nation. And provided you don't elect more socialist dildos like the ones in office now, they won't be able to use that revenue stream to build up a bigger police state and more socialism, and you could actually have your country restored. But that's not going to happen if we're taking all of our vital resources, putting ourselves more in debt, more in hock to China, in order to invade every friggin' country on the globe with no interest of our. And it is up to you, because people like Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Justin Amash, Paul Braun, they cannot do this without support from you. Call in number is 646-649-1013. We got about a half hour left. We'd like to hear from you what your thoughts are about America's foreign policy, where we're going, and you know, your perspective on what happened with Benghazi. 646-649-1013.
Well, absolutely, Rex, and you're talking about the issue of money. I think a lot of people don't understand or might not see the connection between the money trust or the Federal Reserve system, fiat money, and how does that lead to warfare. But as Cicero said back during the Roman period, the sinews of war are infinite money. Warfare needs a nonstop supply of money to keep paying for all of this stuff. And it's impossible. You can't really have an infinite amount of money, but that doesn't mean you can't try. And they've tried over and over again. And what the Romans did was they started debasing the currency. So they had actual coins of gold and silver. And when it came time to pay the military, they said, well, you know what? Turns out we don't have enough gold to pay everybody. And they said, okay, well, let's put, you know, 5% base metal in it. Okay, boom, all of a sudden we've got all the money that we need. Nobody's going to miss 5%. And then the next year, let's put 2% more. Let's put 1% more. Until, you know, these coins exist forever. So you can dig them up, and you can look over time, and you can track inflation in the Roman Empire. Until within the Roman Empire, you can enforce the currency system through force. You have to accept this at face value because we say it has that worth. This is the whole, you know, you're losing money every time you make a penny argument. But why is it accepted? Because you can pay your taxes in it, and the government will accept it at face value because the government is issuing it. But if you live out on the Roman frontier, and there are no cities out there except the barbarian cities that happen to be living near your fort who are selling you goods, and you go out and you want to buy God only knows what, a beer that night or something, and you hand them a coin, and they say, you know, this beer costs 2 silver coins, and you hand them 2 Roman silver coins. They're like, there's no silver in those, so I'm not taking them, because I have real beer, and you have fake silver coins. So, you know, you're not coming into my establishment and counterfeiting me. And it became a real problem. And then all of a sudden you have the Roman Empire, the Roman armies are like, well, this is BS. I'm out here. I'm actually getting killed, and I'm being paid in counterfeit money. I'm going to say that my general is now the emperor of Rome, and let's go march on Rome. Let's take it over, and then he'll get the gold, and he'll actually pay us and screw everybody else. And that happened. And they had something like 30 emperors in 60 years, and those were only the ones that were officially emperor. There were hundreds of others. Basically, it was a nonstop period of civil war for over 50 years as a new emperor came into power, and he had to fight everybody else who's marching on Rome until you got Diocletian, who came in. And Diocletian, one of the first things he did, and probably the smartest thing he did, everything else he did was pretty stupid, but he minted a new coin called the Solidus Aureus, the solid gold, and he paid his soldiers in solid gold money. And that ended the civil war. Sound money. And it ended nonstop warfare in the empire.
It's the same issue with any empire that seeks war. The biggest problem that all of the medieval kings had whenever they wanted to go to war was that they had to raise the treasure, which is they taxed the people. When you tax the people too much, you impoverish your country, and you couldn't draw any more ability to get what you needed for war material. And so what happens is, you know, there's a fighting season, there's a decisive victory, and it actually enhances just war theory, where you would only go into war when absolutely necessary for just reasons, when you don't have, like you said, that infinite supply of money. So getting to the root of the problem is very important. And as we talked about last week, the Founding Fathers gave us a model by which you wouldn't have perpetual warfare, because you wouldn't have a standing army, because you would have the militia of the several states. And some of the governors are now moving in that direction. In fact, I believe that Eric Holder has sent something like 12 or 24 of them letters letting them know that they will be arrested if they pursue this course of action. So clearly, those two things, sound money and the militia of the several states, will actually enhance our position of not having this interventionist foreign policy. But that isn't going to happen unless you get involved and get yourself educated.
Absolutely. Well, I have seen, and I'm interested now because you mentioned 24 states. I wasn't aware it was that many. I've heard about Kansas, and I've heard about gosh, now I'm going to forget if it's Georgia or Alabama, but they said that any sort of federal gun restriction law, they weren't going to enforce because it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And they passed resolutions in the state legislatures about that, which I guess all of this is going to be litigated, and you'll get a decision, but I wasn't aware it was 24. I know this is an issue Chris pays attention to a lot. Is that what's going on that front? Now I'm curious.
Sorry, I was near another noise machine. Yeah, I've heard that too. I haven't gotten in detail on that yet. I just because most of the legislation has been moving through, and we have yet to have everything, you know, totally like governor signing stuff and things like that. So I'm a little bit. I got a little catching up to do on that one.
It sounds like fun. Don't quote me on that 24 number, but I remember seeing something like that. But I think it's a couple of things. I know Jan Brewer just vetoed legislation that would have made gold and silver legal tender in Arizona. She cited some reason of, you know, it needs more investigation. I'm not sure how valid that is. But she also just recently signed a bill activating and calling up the volunteer militia of Arizona. And that's one of the targets. The other thing is that, as you said, several states have passed laws that they will not – that they will arrest federal agents that come in to violate the Second Amendment within the state. And a lot of states now have bills where if a gun is manufactured, produced, sold, and distributed within their state, federal gun laws do not apply. And that doesn't violate the, quote, Commerce Clause of the Constitution because it is not outside of the state. So the real fight is having to come from the states. That's why our Founding Fathers gave us a federalist system, but it is only as strong as the citizens of those states. And your strength is in your knowledge. So you have to read the Constitution. You have to read a commentary on it that is written by not Harvard-educated guys citing precedent, but from the guys that actually drafted the documents and the ratification conventions. And nullification is not a code word for secession. Nullification is a legitimate process by which the states, according to the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, can negate federal laws that are outside of the enumerated powers. Now, a lot of these federal douchebags have been saying the Supremacy Clause says that all federal laws are supreme no matter what, which is not true. Federal laws trump state laws when those laws are within the enumerated powers of Congress. When they are outside of those enumerated powers, state laws trump. The rights and the powers not given to the federal government are reserved to the states and to the people. I'm paraphrasing, but you can look it up. So, you know, the most important process is to get educated. And the other thing to realize is all the stuff that's going on, especially this Benghazi debacle, what it proves to you is how weak they are. See, every day you turn on the news, right, which is, you know, 96% of it, even the alternate media, is owned by six corporations that are basically interlocking directorates of these same pricks that want us in all these wars and want the police state in place. And they gin up your fear. And fear causes paralysis. And so you think that we're losing. And then you see what happened in Tampa. And then you see the RNC not changing the rules to allow the grassroots a voice and all this kind of stuff. Those are just rules, and they're desperate measures of desperate little men who are trying to hold on to their corruption and their power. Why? Because they're afraid of you. There's always more of us than there is of them. We have the power, and the fact is we're winning. That's why they're taking these extreme measures. They are scared to death up on that hill of guys like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. Harry Reid went so far as to call Ted Cruz a schoolyard bully. And Ted Cruz responded to him and says, I didn't know we were in a schoolyard. You know, they say that he's rude and he's boisterous. Why? Because he actually challenges them on doing their job, on upholding and defending the Constitution. If you want more people like that doing the right things for you, standing up for your rights as your servants, which is what elected office is supposed to be, then you've got to exercise your power. And your power is your knowledge. You're an American. Figure out what that means. You have rights guaranteed by the Constitution, not created by it. Rights are pre-existing a priori. They already belong to you. Otherwise, they're just state-granted privileges. So educate yourself. And as Dr. Ron Paul said, once you start the intellectual revolution, it cannot be stopped. And no, it's not going to be a smooth sailing. There's going to be lots of setbacks, and you are fighting a very powerful and entrenched interest. But you're winning. And now is not the time to cower in fear. Now is not the time to sit back. Now is not the time to look at this Benghazi thing and say, you know what, let's let them have a couple of the hearings and get away with it. Press them. Get the truth. Heads must roll. People must be held accountable for the loss of American lives and for destabilizing the world and causing people's deaths in your name.
Well, and just to bring it a little bit full circle to the topic that sort of got us started on this, which is, you know, we're winning this argument about the direction of the party, which is supposed to be the opposition party, and where it's going, because in response to the defeat in 2012, the leadership has been coming to all of us and saying, well, the reason we lost is because you guys are wrong, and you're going to have to start agreeing with us, and you're going to have to start becoming the Rhino Party and telling the lie. And well, everybody knows, every good company, corporation knows that when you hit hard times, you go back to your core competencies and what you do best, and you rebuild from there. The current leadership is like, no, we need to throw all of that away, and we need to get into an entirely new business model, which is the Xerox business, and we need to copy everything the Democrats do and copy off of their paper, and that's going to be our path.
Oh, you mean like immigration?
Yeah, Marco Rubio. And, you know, that's going to be our path to success, because then people literally won't have a choice, and it'll be all based off personality, and we'll have a national nice-off as to who's the nicest guy or the best manager to take the country in the direction that nobody wants to go in. That's their vision. and it's not going to work. But, you know, we have to understand that this element of foreign adventurism is part of what is affecting the economy of this country, because we're plowing tons of money into it, and people's lives are going into this thing. And this is getting us blowback. We're not getting, you know, you mentioned the thing about the oil contracts that Donald Trump was saying probably about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago now. He's like, Libya, we decided to help Libya. You know, the opposition was completely on its back. They would have taken any deal that we offered them, and we should have said, look, we'll help you out. We'll get rid of Gaddafi for you, but we want 50% of your oil revenue, right? I mean, that's old school, but that's a successful business model in international affairs. You know, there's a lot to recommend doing that. Otherwise, don't do it, because what do we have now? We didn't get anything out of this conflict, and they're killing us. And now we have this big investigation over Benghazi. What was the point of this? You got rid of Gaddafi. Okay, now look, I'll tell you. On the crazy scale, Gaddafi was several deviations from normal. And just statistically, anybody that you get to replace Gaddafi statistically is likely to be more sane. So getting rid of Gaddafi is kind of a good thing, because it's like, you know, going and, you know, going to Vegas and taking a gamble. Pretty much you're going to get a better guy than Gaddafi was. But other than that, what do we care? How is this benefiting us? It doesn't benefit us. So, you know, give it a rest. We got problems here at home. We don't need to be all over the place inflating the currency to afford conflicts that are doing nothing for us except leading to other conflicts that have to be funded with money that we don't have and lives that we don't want to waste. It just seems like a losing proposition.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah. Well, and to spin off of what Tech said, I think this is really important for people to understand this. Most of our conflicts and our foreign entanglements have to do with what Rex said earlier, and Tex said again, is the economic game. And when you look at these countries that are sick of the U.S., you know, cheapening its dollar, and you know, like Texas example of the Roman Empire was paying soldiers with bad money, and the people weren't taking the money, you know, and they were breaking down the system. And that's what's happening around the world. There's a lot of countries around the world who no longer want to use the U.S. dollar for oil trade or trade dollars. And one of them being China, Russia, Syria, Iran, Libya. A lot of these countries are going, we're sick of your bad money and we're sick of your bad politics. We're going to do our own thing. Well, that freaks out the money bankers, you know, the people, whether it's the Europe's version of the Fed or the Fed, you know, who want to print money and play king of the world, you know, off of paper money, which has never worked in the history of the world, and countries are getting sick to death of it. And they think, these powers that be think they can use the U.S. military to stop all these people from doing it. Well, that means you're going to have to go to war with Russia and China too. And so, you know, that's kind of an ugly proposition, because those two countries together, that's pretty serious shit. And they got nukes too. So this game we're playing is a game of chicken that I don't think we're in a good position for, because we're definitely not healthy as a nation. Anyway, that was my input on that one. Hello.
No, I think you got it. I mean, economics, look, ultimately, what is economics? You know, everybody talks about the economy. Economics is nothing more than free people trading in those things they need and desire, and innovating and developing. And basically, in a true free market, the success goes to the one who can benefit the most people for the lowest cost with the highest quality. And that's how we unleashed the human creative power to develop all of the things that have improved everybody's life across the world, for the most part. At least if you think about the average person in the industrialized West today, we live better than the wealthiest of the wealthy 200 years ago. So you can improve people materially by unleashing these economic forces without manipulation, but of course greedy men who don't like competition will never you know, settle for that. They want to crowd out the market so that they can always win it. But in the meantime, you have possibly raised people's material utility. Despite the debasing of the currency, not because of it, I know there are some people on the left who think that Keynesianism is responsible for our innovation. Actually, I would argue that American innovation has benefited the world despite the debasement of the currency, not because of it. But what we have done is we've impoverished ourselves morally and culturally in the process. And we misidentify who our true friends and who our true enemies are because of this economic distortion along with cultural Marxism, or what most people call political correctness. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, Chris, you mentioned, you know, how do these liberals justify promoting Sharia extremist Muslim jihadists who really stand on the opposite side of the street from there and would kill them in a heartbeat because of their liberal ideas? Well, it's because of this political correctness where, you know, everything has to be accepted and tolerated, and everybody has to be a hero for finding their voice and their truth as opposed to seeking what is true and what is beautiful and what is good, which is precisely what the American experiment in self-governance is about. It is about leaving people to their own devices so that they can, through their own virtue and mutually beneficial cooperation, not coerced cooperation, find what is true and beautiful and good. And the interesting thing is that today, Pope Francis, who happens to be getting a lot of favor from the left mainstream media over and against Pope Benedict, who is perceived as a hardliner, conservative, backwards thinking, trying to take us back to the 15th century guy, he broke Blessed John Paul II's record for canonizing the most saints by double. He canonized 802 saints today at the Vatican. 800 of them were from a village in Italy who stood up to the Turkish Muslim invaders in the 15th century. And they were told, all the men between the ages of 15 and 65, I think, were told that if they converted to Islam, that their lives would be spared. And they stood up and they said, no, our faith is in Jesus Christ and we won't convert. All of them were beheaded, martyred, for standing up for what they believed in. That kind of thing now is being played out as, oh, it's kind of controversial. Why did Benedict do this to Francis? Because Benedict actually announced this canonization on February 12th when he announced his stepping down from Pope and becoming Pope Emeritus. Well, it's important to note that Muhammad's ideology, and this is not an indictment on Muslim people because you have freedom of religion in this country, so if you're a Muslim and you want to worship that way, totally within your rights. But the ideology that is in places like Saudi Arabia, now Egypt, Libya, some elements in Syria, is to have this kind of economic plunder, we're talking about economics, under the guise of this religion. And we're afraid to say that. Well, they've been trying it for 14 centuries. Now, this is not an indictment on all Muslim people. I would argue most Muslims don't want to plunder. Most Muslims are secular or just faithful, pious Muslims. But there is an element, and it is a large element. And for us to ignore that is how you end up in situations like Benghazi, how you end up with the Muslim Brotherhood in charge of Egypt. It's how you end up with toppling a secular Arab regime in order to replace it with a Muslim Sharia-type nation state, right? This is very dangerous stuff. So you have to identify who is the problem, and you also have to identify who are the friends. And sometimes friends don't necessarily have to be just like us. You know, Hosni Mubarak was our, quote, friend. Was he a good guy? By all accounts, not really. And I think actually he's being retried again next month, if I'm not mistaken, in court there. But there was a stability. And if you notice that since the 1973 October war between Egypt under Sadat and Israel, which was the only one of the major Middle Eastern wars that Israel suffered a defeat in, there's been a peace between Egypt and Israel. Well, now we've just toppled that regime through the, quote, Arab Spring, which was a leftist-inspired collectivist ideology, and now the Muslim Brotherhood's in charge. And this guy that sits in the White House decided that you only get 7 rounds in your gun, but he shipped F-16s and weapons and money off to the Muslim Brotherhood. Some of those weapons ended up in Israel's backyard. Now, if that's your greatest ally in the Middle East, why in the hell are you doing that? And that's the kind of problems you're going to keep getting when you don't respect other people's sovereignty. And this government is not only not respecting foreigners' sovereignty, it's not respecting yours. And they're about to find a way, under the guise of the Tea Party darling Marco Rubio, to legitimize 11 to 20 million foreign invaders in your country. That's a pretty big concern.
Yeah, especially when it's going to cost a rough estimate for the 11 million is $6.3 trillion by the Heritage Foundation. And we all know it's not 11. We know it's a much bigger number because they're going to bring back all the people they kicked out and all their family members, because we still have chain migration in the system instead of needs-based immigration, you know, like it used to be in the old days for most of Americans' history. So, and it is amazing to me how many people still do not understand. Yes, they will get welfare and all the social programs. They do already. It is amazing to me how many people do not. I still have people saying, well, they don't get welfare. They're illegals. Oh, the hell they don't. You know, and if that's the level of knowledge of people who are looking at and debating this issue, I feel sorry for my country. People need to learn and educate themselves and learn to be critical thinkers and quit listening to damn mainstream media and learn some things. This immigration bill is going to, I called it Obamacare 2 before Rand did, so I coined that phrase.
Nice. Yeah, Obamacare 2, right? So here's my question then.
If the same
quote Internal Revenue Service, which is nothing more than the collection arm of the Federal Reserve scheme, is going to run your health care, in what universe does it make any sense that your tax collector is going to be running your health care program? Are they going to also be running our immigration program? I mean, are we just going to kind of hand all, you know, executive authority over to this IRS? This is the kind of crazy stuff that happens when you get out of the bounds of the Constitution. Gentlemen, we're in the last 8 minutes, so why don't we, Chris, I know you just wrapped up there, but why don't you go ahead and give us some final thoughts and maybe, you know, try to bring it back to this whole Benghazi cover-up, and then we'll go to Tex, and then I'll bring it on home.
Oh, I thought you were going to go to Tex. Well, you know, I think that the Benghazi thing is a doorway. That's all it is. It's a window. It's a hot issue right now. It's being exposed. The whistleblowers have come out. They've testified. So it's rattled the cage. But I really think that, you know, like what we've talked about tonight, that you got to chase, you got to go through that doorway and look at all the different things that are connected, because it's the foreign policy of the last 4 years of this presidency and whatever games they're playing over there and whatever games their handlers are playing, because it's insane. Whether it's Egypt, whether it's Libya, what's going on, the lies in Syria. When you look at, like I said, look at that map, that north end of that, you know, Iran, and realize that Iran is a very, very important strategic pathway to multiple places in the world. And if you know people in the Air Force, you'll also know that there's a lot of strategic things to do with flight patterns and things like that. And there's another one, and that is the pipelines. You got to do some research into this stuff to understand all the games that are being played. And of course, Rex and Tex both have talked about the economics of it. So, you know, this thing is all we've talked about bits and pieces of this whole conversation for the year we've been talking. And I think that Benghazi just kind of like, it just kind of became a laser beam that pulled everything together, because all these spinoffs and these different topics, although you could have a whole show on, you know, Egypt or a whole show on Syria, they're all interrelated to everything that we're doing, even back to immigration. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, the dynamics of this immigration reform, and you're like, oh, my God, what are they doing to this country while we're over in these other countries, and what the hell are we doing over there? So it's a big conversation, and there's a lot of twists and turns, but it's definitely a sign of things to come. That's my point.
Okay. All right, and you can catch up with Chris at Coalition of Freedom on Facebook and text to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't fix it. That's the problem. It's not fixable. It's not something the United States can go in and go fix every country on planet Earth and make it in its image or the way it wants them to be. It can't create virtue in other countries. It can't create or implant the desire for these sorts of things. Maybe you can do it in a few places. You know, we seem to have done it in Germany and Korea, Japan. You know, we kind of changed the nature of those societies, but those were some pretty, you know, bloody conflicts that we fought with them, and you concentrated effort in those areas. But every time you go and try to fix one of these countries and then move on to the next one, you're still taking care of that first one. It's not done yet. That cake is not baked, and you keep getting pulled back into it. And this is imperial overreach. You're getting stretched thinner and thinner and thinner. And Rome, they said Rome ended up in an empire in a fit of absent-mindedness because it was always fighting what it thought were defensive wars. And so to defend Italy, you've got to have Corsica and Sardinia, and then you've got to have North Africa, and you need France, too. And then you might as well go ahead and get Croatia and Serbia so that now, you know, Italy is defended. But now to defend that, you need Spain, and pretty soon you need everything in order to defend it all. Well,
yeah,
it's insane. There's no end to it. And now you've made the entire world your enemy.
And then Germany comes down the pike.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the Romans, they were basically an empire of accountants, and they had bad maps. And they realized that if you try to defend the Rhine-Danube line, you end up with a salient around when you approach Switzerland. They're like, well, it's never good to have a salient. Then we have to have, like, 30% more forts than if we had the Oder-Neisse line. The Oder-Neisse line is a lot thinner, so if we invaded Germany, we made Germany a province, we would have a much smaller border against the barbarians to defend, and we could, like, cut costs 30% on this empire thing we got going here. And they're like, hey, that's a great idea, we should totally do that. The only problem is you have to attack Germany and defeat the Germans, and they sent 3 legions in, and, you know, they were never seen again. Actually, they only discovered those legions. They found where they were about 7 years ago now in the Teutoburg Forest. They actually found the site of the battle. But that amount of military force, by the way, was 10% of the Roman army marched into Germany and was never heard from again for 2,000 years.
Yeah, and history repeats itself, because any time you economically impoverish the Germans, things tend to go quite badly, and the EU is pretty much doing that. That thing's falling apart, and, you know,
good.
We should not follow that example. What we need to do is come back home. We need to bring home our forces. We need to bring back sound money. We need to diffuse power according to the system of free states and commonwealths, and restore the militia of the several states, which is not some independent private army. It is a legitimate function of the Second Amendment. It is a well-regulated militia under the auspices of the state and commonwealth governments. And this thing in Benghazi is going to keep developing, and we're going to keep getting more information. So keep your eye on it, because this is not about merely a dereliction of duty. This is not merely about a cover-up of incompetence or negligence or some dastardly deed. This is the epitome of how a corrupt few can become a parasitic element within your government. And liberty requires perpetual vigilance. Instead of sitting back and watching television, stuffing your face with Cheetos, and worrying about your trivial affairs, realize something. All of the issues that you have and all the problems you have in your life stem from the fact that your country is becoming unstable. It's becoming unstable because there are people in power who are trying to take it away from you. But there are more of us than there are of them. And so long as we're united and resolute under the banner of the Constitution, we can be a nation with liberty for all. Get yourself informed. Get educated. Wake others up. and stand up. You're an American. It's an honor. It's a privilege. It's worth fighting for. This is Texan Rex, signing off.
The flames of liberty will never die.
Lying, walk by in my wearing socks from my double barrel.